If any other children are out there in the chairs, you're welcome to come forward now and sit on the quilts. One of the ways that we can build bridges between our divisions, build connections across differences, is by learning one another's languages. One of the things I love about the Spirit of Life song you just sang is that you did it in three different languages. Raise your hand if you can name one language. French. English. What was the last language? Sign language. Three languages. Learning someone else's language is a good way to get to know someone. It is also a very good way to live out our first Unitarian Universalist principle, respecting and honoring each individual person. Learning someone else's language can be an act of respect. Instead of expecting that everyone should learn whatever language we speak, we open ourselves to learning a language that somebody else speaks. Like in this book. It's a Canadian girl book. I don't know if any of you know this book. This one's about Emily, who lived in Victoria about 100 years ago. There's a picture that you guys can pass around. So in this story, Emily is a Canadian whose family came from England, and she has a friend who you see in the picture there, Mayuk, who is a Canadian whose family came from China. Emily teaches Mayuk English, and Mayuk teaches Emily Cantonese, which is a Chinese language. One of the things that Emily learns about is Chinese New Year. What day is Chinese New Year starting on this year? Anyone know? Tommy? Today! Today is the first year of the Chinese New Year. Now, last year was the year of the dragon. Raise your hand if you know what this year is, the year of... Do you know what this year is? What is it? What animal? You want a hint? What animal makes that sound?
Snake!
It's the year of the snake! Indeed. Does anyone know how to wish someone a happy new year in Cantonese? Evie does. Go ahead, Evie. Gung hei fat choy. Gung hei fat choy. Let's all say it together. Gung hei fat choy. Excellent. It literally means congratulations and be prosperous. I read somewhere that they say congratulations for making it through the winter. We can say congratulations for making it through flu season, if you've done that quite yet. So that's one more language that you all know. Some of the kids in the intermediate class and the coming of age group are going to Chinatown today. Whether you celebrate the new year at Chinatown or at school or somewhere else, you can greet folks with this new year's greeting. What is it again? Gung hei fat choy. Very nice. Well, happy new year to all of you. You guys can go to your classes now while the grown-ups stand and form the arches, and we'll sing in two languages. Our meditation today is in music and in silence. I invite you to do whatever you need to do to make this a meditative time for you. When we are in music, sing along or hum along or just listen. When we are sharing the silence, pray or meditate or just breathe deeply. We will begin with hymn number 194. You can remain seated and sing prayerfully. 194. I'd like to begin by inviting you to read with me responsively number 584 in the back of your hymn books. 584. The famous words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., African-American advocate of racial equality, economic justice, and peace for all. I will read the plain text. I invite you to read the italics. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. There are some things in our social system to which all of us ought to be maladjusted. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. Before it is too late, we must narrow the gaping chasm between our proclamations of peace and our lowly deeds which precipitate and perpetuate war.
One day we must come to see that peace is not merely a distant goal,
but a means by which we arrive at that goal. We must pursue peaceful ends through peaceful means. Thank you. Martin Luther King, Jr. could have been a Unitarian Universalist. In fact, he considered it, but intentionally decided against joining our liberal faith. Unitarian Universalist minister Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt writes about what she learned about this unfulfilled possibility from Dr. King's wife, Coretta Scott King. McNatt recalls that Mrs. King told her something like this: "Oh, I went to Unitarian churches for years, even before I met Martin. And Martin and I went to Unitarian churches when we were in Boston. We gave a lot of thought to becoming Unitarian at one time. But Martin and I realized that we could never build a mass movement of black people if we were Unitarian." Why not? Reverend McNatt points out that one of the reasons was that our Unitarian Universalist theology would not have been strong enough to support Dr. King's work. She cites his writings in which he states that religious liberalism was too naively optimistic about human nature. Our theology, he thought, did not adequately deal with the human tendency to do truly sinful things. Furthermore, though King liked that liberal religion valued reason and the continual search for truth, he felt that the emphasis we placed on reason often left no space for a relational experience with a personal God. Dr. King found in Christianity powerful tools that addressed both the why and the how of anti-racism. Why should we fight racism? Dr. King was able to answer along these lines: because racism is an evil. Racial hatred is a sin. Our God suffers with those of us who are oppressed and calls us all to work towards justice and freedom. And how should we fight racism? Dr. King's theology allowed him to respond, "Our God will give us the tools we need to do this work, strength, comfort, grace, and a powerful love that can change the world." Naming racism as a sin, a personal God that calls you to do justice and gives you the tools you need, that's pretty solid grounding for anti-racism. We Unitarian Universalists don't even all believe in God, let alone use the word sin or evil Do we have reasons for fighting racism that are deeper than because it seems like the right thing to do? Can we find a solid theological grounding for our anti-racism work that answers both the why and the how? Over the past several years, I've come to believe that in spite of the wide range of our various theologies, Buddhist, Christian, humanist, and so on, in spite of this wide theological variance among us, we do share in common two theological beliefs. Not just ethical statements about how we should behave, but theological statements about how things are in this world. One, every person, all life is valuable. Two, all life is a part of an interdependent web of existence. So my question today is, can those two beliefs give theological grounding to our work in anti-racism? Whether we are demonstrating our solidarity with our Jewish brothers and sisters, as we did a year ago when the Jewish cemetery in Victoria was desecrated with swastikas, or whether we are working with First Nations people to address the injustices that they have endured, as we are now with our February Social Action of the Month, does our theology both call us to right action and support us in the work we do for justice? That is, does it give us a reason for the why we do anti-racism, as well as tools for how we do anti-racism? Let's look at the why first. If we are all valuable and we are all connected, then this state of things calls us to do justice. What I do to hurt you hurts me. What I do to help you helps me. The reasoning is in the words of Martin Luther King that we just read together. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This calls us to right action. I have felt this truth on an emotional level in two different contexts. Though I identify as lesbian now, when I was in college, I identified as straight. I was in love with a boy and everything. If that doesn't make sense to you, you can ask me to explain it later. For now, just take it as a given. I tell this story from the perspective of a straight college girl. I was straight, but I had several gay friends, and to show my support for them, I went to a march in Washington, D.C. for gay rights. When I was at that march, I had a little epiphany. I realized that I was not just marching for the rights of my gay friends. I was marching for my own rights as a straight woman. I saw in a flash how the same fears of gender bending that feed homophobia also oppress all of us, men and women, gay and straight. Those societal norms that say a woman should behave and look this way, and a man should look and behave that way, were damaging to all of us. I was standing there in a miniskirt and combat boots with long hair and unshaved legs, and I realized that in fighting homophobia, I was fighting for my own rights. For my own freedom to look and act in whatever way felt authentic to me, unrestricted by the confines of how people wanted and expected a person of my gender to look and act. Same thing happened in a different context. In my 20s, I did a lot of personal anti-racism work, the kind in which you examine your own prejudices, those settled judgments and stereotypes that you pick up from movies and popular culture, the kind of anti-racism work in which you learn about what is called white privilege, the privileges I, as a Caucasian person, enjoy that I don't even notice, like that I can easily find Band-Aids that match my skin tone, or that when I interact with a police officer, the police officer tends to trust me. Not the case for many non-Caucasians, be they First Nations in Canada or African American in the States. I learned about personal prejudices that I had unwittingly absorbed. I learned about systemic racism that works in governments and cultures to keep oppressed people down. And I learned ways to work in solidarity with oppressed people to fight racism in myself, in others, in larger systems. At some point, while I was doing this anti-racism work, I realized that I was not only doing it to help visible minorities, or as some non-Caucasians refer to themselves, people of color. I wasn't just doing anti-racism work to help others. I was doing anti-racism work for myself, too. I did it because I hated that sick-to-my-stomach feeling I got when I was anywhere where racial tensions were palpable. It's not just that I hated witnessing how racism hurts people of color, which is true, but also I hated how racism made me feel about myself. The guilt of white privilege, the fear of saying something racist, feelings of discomfort about being Caucasian when I was a minority in the presence of people of color. I hated racism because of how it affected me. So you see, in both these cases, straight girl marching for gay rights, white woman working against racism, I felt it on a gut level. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. The injustice that oppresses someone else also hurts me. Whether we are Aboriginal, visible minority, invisible minority, or Caucasian, we fight racism for everyone's sake, including our own. For one cannot really be separated from the other. So our theological common ground, our Unitarian Universalist beliefs that we are all valuable and all interconnected in the web of life, can motivate us in a deep, emotionally rooted way to fight racism. That addresses the why we do racism. What about the how we do racism work? Does our theological common ground give us tools to fight racism? Does it give us an approach? I don't have it all figured out yet, but I found some starting places. I will leave the larger scale political how-tos for another time, and for now, we'll focus on how we grapple with racism on a personal level. And before we talk about how to address the problem, let's first take a stab at diagnosing the problem. Bill Sinkford, former president of the Unitarian Universalist Association and the first African American to serve in that role, has said this of our efforts in anti-racism, quote, "Our central spiritual challenge in this work is to cease being afraid." Fear. Let's look at how fear upholds racism. I should say at this juncture that throughout this sermon, I will be talking from my own perspective, the perspective of a well-meaning white person. But I imagine that a lot of these experiences and feelings are shared by well-meaning people of other races as well. Perhaps not with regard to white people, the people in power, but perhaps with regard to other non-white races different from one's own. Asians regarding First Nations people, Black Canadians regarding Asians, and so on. We were looking at the fear that upholds racism. If you cannot identify with the word fear, you might try on its less intense cousin, discomfort. Here's a sampling of what I'm talking about. Fear of saying the wrong thing. Fear of being wrongly accused of racism. Fear of being rightly accused of racism. Fear of losing privilege, fear of guilt, fear of or discomfort with the other, someone who is different from you. I'll give you three real-life examples from my own experiences with these fears and discomforts. Example number one. For the offertory for a worship service I was doing in the States on the topic of racism, The music coordinator, we'll call her Lori, suggested the African-American spiritual Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. It's a beautiful song. But as I pictured how it would play out in that particular service, I began to feel a little uncomfortable. The singer would be white, singing a song created by African Americans who suffered under slavery. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows my sorrow. Having a white person sing that song in the context of that service felt like stealing someone else's story. Maybe in a service on the topic of suffering in general, it would be fine for a white person to sing it, but when the suffering we're talking about is racism, it just didn't seem respectful. I felt uneasy about the message it would send out to the people in the pews. I also felt a touch uneasy about how to share my concern with Lori, who had suggested the song. I didn't want her to feel that I was accusing her of being racist. As it turns out, she did not feel accused. She took my input in stride, but she commented on the way that I expressed my concern. "You sounded so uncomfortable," she said. I said it was because I didn't want to hurt her feelings, which was true, but my discomfort was probably also heightened because it was such a loaded issue. Maybe racism is not as much of a loaded topic in Canada as it is in the States, but maybe you can understand my story anyway. The word racist is one of the worst insults you can lay on a liberal, small l, liberal. I bend over backwards to not do or say anything that someone can interpret as racist, and I'm equally sensitive to doing and saying anything that others can misinterpret as me accusing them of being racist. Sadly, I think discomfort with the topic of racism can often cause us liberals, especially white liberals, to remain silent when we need to speak up. We'd rather not take the risk of someone thinking we're racist, so we avoid talking about race, except in the very safest of situations, like sharing our thoughts on race in a group of close friends of the same race, or condemning institutions or politicians that are openly, unapologetically racist. Maybe part of the discomfort around the topic of race is due to the fact that we all have some racist tendencies. It's not necessarily anyone's fault. It would be hard to grow up in North America and not absorb at least some of the racism, sexism, and homophobia that is so prevalent in our culture. Much of it, I cringe to say, imported from the United States. Maybe we are reluctant to talk about race because we don't want people to find out that some of those stereotypes and prejudices have tainted our own attitudes. There's a great song in a musical that was out a while back, Avenue Q. Do you guys know Avenue Q? Some of you, yeah. As some of you know, Avenue Q is a sort of adult version of Sesame Street for contemporary times. It has Muppets and everything. In this one scene, the character named Princeton asks Kate Monster, very tentatively, "You're a monster, right?" And Trekkie Monster, upstairs, "He's a monster. Are you two related?" Kate Monster says in a huff, "Princeton, I'm surprised at you. I find that racist. What are you trying to say? That we all look the same to you?" Princeton admits that what he said was a little racist, and then points out how Kate has some racist thoughts also. Thus enlightened, the two of them break into song. I want you to get a sense of the upbeat tune, so I'm going to try it. Here we go. "Everyone's a little bit racist sometimes. Doesn't mean we go around committing hate crimes. If we all could just admit that we are racist a little bit, even though we all know that it's wrong, maybe it would help us get along." Thank you. The sing-songy tone of it is catchy. It somehow undercuts our fear. Bill Sinkford's words resurface. Our central spiritual challenge in this work is to cease being afraid. We can walk through our own fear. We can decide to take the risk of talking about race and racism. And when we say something that reveals racist thinking, instead of spending our energy on guilt and shame and defensive denial, we can just admit it. We don't have to be so afraid of being called racist. It is good to identify racism when we see it. Helping each other identify it and understand it helps us fight it. Racism thrives on silence. By the way, when calling someone else on their racism, I find that instead of saying, "You're racist," a more effective opener is, "You don't really mean that the way it sounds, do you?" That allows the both of you to look at and talk about the racism without accusing the person of intentional malicious thinking. Still talking about liberal fears and discomfort around race, here's another scenario. I was sitting with my friends Mark and Ellen, both white, in the living room of Mark's house, which he shared with four other housemates. An Asian guy popped his head in from the kitchen to say hi. Mark introduced us, asking if we had met before. I said no. Ellen said, "Yeah, sure, I've met you once. You're Chris, Mark's housemate." The guy said, "No, actually I'm Tom, Susan's boyfriend." Ellen had mistaken Tom for Chris. They are both Asian. Ellen was clearly mortified. "I'm so sorry." Tom responded, "It's okay, we all look alike, you know." He said it in a joking tone of voice, but inwardly I cringed. Ugh, I was just glad that I had not met Chris or Tom before. I could have easily made the same mistake. The three of us, Mark, Ellen, and I, talked about the incident over dinner later that night. Ellen said she felt horrible. She has lots of Asian friends. It's not like she's not used to seeing Asian people. She couldn't believe her mistake. Mark was trying to make her feel better, saying it wasn't that big a deal. It's not like she'd said something racist. Ellen and I argued that actually it was racist. It wasn't based on malicious intent. That's true. But it is a symptom of racism when you fail to see the individual identity of a person of a different race. Ellen probably would not have made the mistake if Chris and Tom were both white. Failing to see the individual identity of a person of a different race does not mean you are a bad person. It might even be human nature to be more sensitive to the physical distinctions between races with which we are most familiar. But because racism thrives on obliterating the individual identity of people of races different from our own, we who want to work against racism should make an effort to counteract those tendencies. We should make an effort to see people of other races as individual people with traits both personal and physical that make them uniquely them. And our last scenario. Once when I was a kid, 9 or 10 years old, I drew what I thought was a political cartoon. At the time, I thought it was rather clever. When I look back on it now, I am horrified at what I drew. I hesitate to even share it, but I am doing so because I think it reflects stuff that is in the subconscious of many white liberals. It reflects a view of the other that kids of any race can absorb from our culture, despite well-intentioned liberal parenting. Here's the context. I was a white kid, a basically good kid, growing up in Los Angeles, California, parented by liberal parents who taught me that prejudice was wrong. Here's what I drew. The single box frame was filled with 20 or so stick figures. 9 of them had their stick figure heads shaded in. This was to represent black people. Another 9 stick figures had red bandanas on their heads. This was to represent Latino people. 2 stick figures in the foreground had unshaded heads and no bandanas. They were the white people. One of them spoke to the other. The caption read, "Have they changed the meaning of the word minority?" Frightening. I could hide behind some sort of logical defense and say that I was honestly puzzled by the meaning of the word minority. It seemed like people were using the wrong word to describe non-white racial groups. In Los Angeles, minority was simply not accurate. I could say that. But my guess is that there was more going on there, on a subconscious emotional level. If asked directly about it, I'm sure I would have said that I did not think there was anything wrong with black people or Latino people. It's not like I thought they were bad or inferior to white people. But doesn't that drawing betray a fear of the other? A fear of being a racial minority myself? If I did not fear those other racial groups on some level, if I felt totally comfortable around them, why would I care about being a racial minority myself? Which, by the way, I wasn't really, not as much as the cartoon suggested. I did not go to a school that was only 10% white. I think this exaggeration also betrays a sense of fear. Another thing going on in this cartoon is that the individuality of all the people of color was completely erased. You could rationalize that simplification is a technique necessary to make your point in a political cartoon, but that would be a rationalization. All of the African American people looked the same. All the Latino people looked the same, with the additional hideous stereotype of a gang-related symbol. And if I remember correctly, I'm not even sure any of these characters had faces. The white characters looked the same too, but since they were speaking, my guess is that they were given faces. Isn't this what racism is built upon? Fear of the other and obliteration of the unique individuality of people of a given racial group. Liberals tend to deny that we have these feelings, but given the racist culture that we've grown up in, I would suspect that shadows of these feelings actually lurk within the subconscious realm of many of our psyches. And here we turn back to our Unitarian Universalist theology. How might our UU theology provide us with tools to fight racism and the fears it is built upon? Let's start with fear of the other. In a book put out by the Unitarian Universalist Association called Soul Work, Anti-Racist Theologies in Dialogue, one of the many authors, Reverend Peter Morales, who is now the president of the UA, talks about how the fear of the other is based on our innate tendency toward tribalism, a tendency he refers to as our original sin. We fear the unknown, and so we, quote, draw lines around those who are part of us and safe, and those who are the other and to be feared. He continues, quote, once we have defined a group of people as other, whether black, brown, Bosnian, Jew, or gay, violence and oppression will follow. So then perhaps the antidote, the way to save ourselves from this sin, is to learn to draw our circles a little wider, to learn to see people who we think of as other as a part of our own kinship circle. The interdependent web part of our UU theology serves as firm grounding for this approach. We humans of every race are kin. We are all tied together in this interdependent web of existence. Theologian Paul Tillich conceived of sin as, quote, estrangement from self, other, and the ground of our being. Translated into our theological language, sin is conceiving of the self as separate from the interdependent web. Salvation for us as individuals and as a collective whole comes from reconnecting, from drawing that circle that encompasses the us ever wider until us includes all of existence and there is no other. When we draw that circle to include all people as us, when we focus on how we are all one, all connected together in this web of life, we need to beware of the trap of colorblindness. Maybe you've heard people say, "I'm colorblind. When I see a person, I hardly notice their race." But a person's race is a part of their individual identity. It shapes their experience in this world. When you ignore a person's race, it can have the same effect as seeing only their race. It eradicates their individuality. We are all one, but we are not all the same. We cannot be truly one until we embrace each other in our differences. Accordingly, when we talk about our common humanity, those of us who are in the dominant groups need to be careful that we're not just using our own selves and culture as the common denominator. We need to refrain from assuming they're really just like me without making much of an effort to get to know them or what makes them different from us. Theologian James Cone, who is not Unitarian Universalist, is an African-American in the Soul Work Dialogues, says this: You can't find our common humanity until you search for it in the other. So it draws you to the other people's particularities and stretches you beyond your own culture. You can't find our common humanity until you search for it in the other, in other people's particularities. And here we pull in the second part of our UU theology, the belief that all people are inherently valuable. If you really respect the inherent worth and dignity of everyone, including those who are different from you, then you must start with where they are. Learn about each person and everything that makes them unique. Learn their language. The more you get to know the particularities of people who are different from you, the more likely you are to see them as individuals. You become less likely to think they all look alike, less likely to draw them without faces in your subconscious. Also, the more you get to know the particularities of people who are a different race from you, the more comfortable you become with those differences. You become less fearful of the other, less likely to even think of them as other, more likely to draw the line of kinship to include them, and thus less likely to fear being a minority in their company. To revise my imprudent childhood drawing, the picture becomes 20 people. I'll keep the racial makeup the same. Still 9 African Americans, 9 Latinos, and 2 whites. But everyone has a face. There are no bandanas. There are at least 10 different skin tones. There are men and women, tall people, short people, all different hairstyles, fat people, thin people, serious people, jovial people, all mixed up and interacting with each other. 20 different individual people, all precious and valuable in their uniqueness, all happily engaged with one another, totally at home with their kin in all their differences. So here's a start to a UU theological grounding for anti-racism. Why do we do anti-racism? Because we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, an interdependent web of existence. How should we do anti-racism? What are some of the tools our theology gives us for this work? Our belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all people calls us to see and honor all the particularities of people of all races. Our belief that we are interconnected in the web of life calls us to draw our kinship circle to include all people of all races. We are called to recognize that we are at once both different and connected. If we are only to focus on our differences, then we end up in fear-based bigotry. If we are only to focus on our connection and similarities, making claims of being colorblind, then we might end up in false harmony, where the dominant culture continues to dominate. But when we hold both, when we see that we are both different and connected, then we can open the door to true community, a loving, diverse human family. And when we start there, the rest of it, speaking up and taking action together to fight the racism that hurts us all, comes naturally. So may it be. Amen.